And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. And we have a humdinger of a show for you tonight. First of all, we'll be coming up with Alejandro Rojas with UFO updates. Then we have about a 10-minute or so pre-recorded clip with Greg Coolidge and Kirk Ward. And they want to talk about their new pilot called Skyward. It's really interesting. It's a kid's show, but it involves a UFO podcast. And it was partially inspired by the show. They got in touch with me about that. So our guest this evening is via phone. I'm very excited about him. I heard him on Alejandro's show. He's great. It's Richard Thieme. And he was part of a UFO history group that spent 5 years writing a book called UFOs and Government, a historical inquiry on top of 50 years of research, gathering documents from the government and elsewhere. He should be a fascinating guest. I'm really excited about that. So a couple of quick announcements. Remember, if you become a member subscriber for only $2 or more per month, you get not only the full shows and archives, but you also get the Everything Else show in the podcast feed. And this week's show was really good. It was about the Dyatlov Pass incident, a very fascinating case. And I spoke with a girl named Teddy, and she has a number 2 website. If you search the Dyatlov Pass incident, her website comes up number 2. Very interesting mountaineer and explorer, and has a really good insight on what possibly happened. Also, I will be up at the Shag Harbor 50th anniversary. I'm going to be recording a live show on YouTube as well with Jordan Bonaparte. That's on September 30th of this month. And that will also be on the live feed as well. So if you want to tune in live, that information will be up on our website during the week. If you can't help us out, you can always listen to the whole show for free at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesdays at podcastufo.com or on YouTube. You can also listen for free on the Dark Matter Digital Network Thursday nights, 10 p.m. till midnight, and on Outworld Fleet Radio on Saturday nights at 6 p.m. That's it for me, Alejandro. What's going on? How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Good. You had an exciting time out there at Devil's Tower. So I can't
Was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear about that.
It was gorgeous out there. The tower is so strange. It's one of those things, just like lots of national monuments, where you have to see it, where pictures don't do it justice. It's just such an interesting place. So it was a lot of fun. The hosts were great. The host, Bob Olson, owns the Best Western there. And then Lori Tucker is someone who lives in the area and put together this group to sponsor this whole event. And she's into UFOs and stuff. And then there was, Richard, who is in charge of Wyoming MUFON. And then Mark D'Antonio. There was Debbie Ziegelmeyer and Chuck Zukowski. And our good buddy Mark D'Antonio and Travis Walton all were out there. In fact, we visited the monument with Travis and did the walk around, and that was a lot of fun. So really cool. And the Sun was there, which is one of these UK tabloids. And you and I complain about these UK tabloids so much all the time, including the Sun. But the writer has been writing a story about the different talks every day this week. So today she wrote about Travis. Yesterday was a really good one. She wrote about Mark D'Antonio, with a story that he shares amongst people but doesn't really share publicly so much. But now this story is public, which is really cool, and he's happy about that. which is essentially when he was on a sub, because he works with the Navy building models and stuff. And he was on a sub when they right next to the sonar guy when they were tracking something moving very fast.
Yeah, and like 200 knots or something crazy.
Yeah, yeah, something crazy. So, and they called it a fast mover. And he said later on he asked one of the guys in the Navy about the fast mover program, and he said, don't ask about that again.
That's right.
And yeah. It was kind of funny. Because when he asked the CEO or the CO on the sub, hey, what was that? The CO said, are you having a good time on the ship? And Mark said, yeah, this has been great. He said, well, let's just keep it that way. So another indication that, sorry, we're not talking about it. So, yeah, that was really good stuff. So she's going to have me in a story, I think, tomorrow or the next day, because my talk was about I did two talks, one of them about Steven Spielberg and then one of them about strange alien cases. And if you've seen this talk, you know one of my cases is about Lord Mountbatten. And Mountbatten is important because he is the uncle of Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth. And Prince Philip was really he saw Lord Mountbatten as his father figure through life. And Mountbatten was very important. He was Admiral of the Fleet. He was the last Viceroy of India. So if you watch Gandhi, he's portrayed in that, an extremely important person. But he was also very much into UFOs, and he believed a UFO landed on his property. So you'll be able to read more about that in that story. But a story I wrote about was with Lee Spiegel, and if you heard my interview with him, you'll know some about it. But this is Spiegel essentially talking about how when he was putting together, hopefully you've had him, I'm talking about this, but the United Nations.
Oh, yeah.
Lee Spiegel was behind, you know, getting the United Nations to do this AV presentation to try to get them to do something about UFOs. And Spielberg actually invited him and Hynek and Vallée to offer his help. So I wrote a story about that. I'm going to put it on the Huffington Post this week also, and I do have a video that I played at my talk that I'll be putting up on YouTube of Lee going over that. So that's really cool. And today, speaking of UFO stuff, today I wrote a story. This is a great story if you haven't heard it, and maybe you've heard this one. So Nick Pope, who worked for the Ministry of Defense UFO desk, when he showed up to work in 1991, there was a poster of a UFO. He said it was this large diamond-shaped metallic object with a jet in the background. So this amazing picture. And I guess he said it's the most spectacular UFO photo he's ever seen. And it was hanging up there on the wall, but eventually it got taken down and it disappeared. And the story behind this is really interesting because it's a real picture. These witnesses took this picture in like 1990 and in the Scotland area. And when he asked, what is this picture? They explained the whole situation. They said, we think it's real. We think it's really, some 80-foot in diameter craft that was seen. And they don't know what it is. They didn't believe it was the Americans. They didn't believe it was belonged to the British, so his boss even said it must then belong to and pointed up. So really interesting case, and what's really cool too is that UK's Channel 5 worked with Nick to recreate this poster, and so it's an incredible image, so I posted that today. So yeah, those are some of the stories out there going on. Otherwise, another really good story today was in the Herald Sun from Australia, because James Fox has been out there working on his latest documentary. Lee Spiegel is helping him actually write the script, but James Fox is out there interviewing people about this Westall UFO case, this famous Australian case that he's going to include in his documentary.
Oh, I'm glad he's including that one. It's a real great one. Well, yep. Thanks so much, Alejandro, and we'll see you next week, right?
All right. Yep. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
See ya.
Bye. All right, everyone. So I'm going to play this clip right now. Hang in there. All right. So I am pre-recording this bit right here. And I am on the line with a couple great guys, Greg Coolidge and Kirk Ward. Now, they have a kids series pilot. It's now on Amazon, and it's called Skyward. And I recommend you check it out. It's a lot of fun. We're going to be talking about that. I'm going to read you a quick synopsis of what it is. Three friends host a secret underground podcast exploring paranormal sightings in their tiny town of Wildwood, Oregon. Together, Piper, Curtis, and Ira try to prove the existence of aliens and can't help but become personally involved with the cases of people who call in their show. So, Kirk and Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us, Martin. Thank you.
Yeah. And so why don't you tell us a little bit how you got inspired to do this and how it all came about?
Well, Greg and I have been working together for years and as a writing team, and we always, when I first met Greg, he would share little UFO things with me, like send me stuff, and I was like, oh wow, he's into this too, you know. So we would send each other different things about sightings, and we just found it fascinating. And I think, speaking for the both of us, we're not really big like sci-fi buffs, but there's always been something about, you know, that we bonded about the universe and that we're not alone and there has to be something out there. And we always had talked about doing a show, you know, with aliens and, you know, like Close Encounters and E.T. and the Goonies, like that type of tone. And we batted around some ideas. And then when my daughter was born, I was reading this article on UFO radio shows in the L.A. Times. I remember because I was up around the clock. I was rocking her in this chair, and I read this article about UFO radio shows, AM radio shows around the country. And it, like I said to you earlier, Martin, we were fans of Coast to Coast and Art Bell. So I brought this article in, and you know, we have a big idea board in our office at Sunset Gara Studios, and we always, you know, when our eyes pop, you know, like I pitched this thing to Greg, and he's like, yes. And that's kind of what you're looking for in a partnership, a writing partnership, is the other person sparking to it. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of on our board for quite some time, and we batted around different ideas. And you know, originally it was going to be more of like a Midnight Caller meets X-Files, and we started to really develop that, and it never really kind of just didn't ever really crack, but we always kept coming back to it. And then one day Greg said, I got it. And usually when he says I got it, and he snaps his fingers, I got it, he's like, what if we make this more of kids and a podcast? And then it was like a whole new explosion. We started like, oh, that's it. And we kind of had another similar idea about kids, this other kind of idea, the similar tone, and we kind of took a lot of that. And I remember the day when it all kind of came together, because it's one of those things that, like, within 45, 50 minutes, you're like, yep, this is it, this is it, this is it. Hmm. So it was really cool. And then we'd met our friend Sabrina Wind, producer on the show. She, you'd know her from Reba, Desperate Housewives, Devious Maids. And she was going, we'd met her, and we were like, hey, we should find a project together. And she heard the logline for this and was like, oh man, this is incredible. And she teamed us up with Jonathan Judge, who is a big kids director. And we had a meeting with him, and he immediately responded to it. And then we went out as a team, and I think we went to just Amazon and Nickelodeon. And Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we just went to those two places, and they both wanted it. And Disney. See,
and Disney wanted it as well, but they were like, "We don't do this kind of stuff."
Oh, really? Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then
we wanted to keep it very grounded. We wanted it to be very Spielbergian. We wanted it to feel very real. And feel like, you know, that adults and kids would enjoy it equally. And so the tone of it is very hard to hit. And that's why Disney said, oh, we don't do that kind of stuff on our, we do it for live action for our feature films, but not for our television station. Go ahead, Kirk.
No, that's exactly right. And that's why we ended up going with, like Greg was saying, with Amazon, because they allowed us you know, to have the tone that we wanted, which is exactly that. It's real. It's grounded. It has heart. You know, there's father and daughter scenes are real. And then there's the comedic element. You know, the comedic elements are still grounded, but come out of the story and come out of kind of the fantasy of, you know, a children's story. So, yeah, that was kind of basically how it all came together. There's a lot more and a longer timeline. But in general, yeah.
Yeah, and now a quick question. You said you listened to the podcast, my podcast. Is that something you did before you thought of this, or was this all in your research?
It was, yeah. I mean, we've always been listening to stuff, but it was when we were developing the show, there was a couple podcasts and a couple of articles and stuff we were reading, and we just liked the how your show was so grounded. Like, we were like, yeah.
Yes.
If she had a podcast, like, we're not going to show a lot of the podcast in the series, you know, because that's not super exciting. But we were like, you know, to show the moments of when she's actually communicating with people that are calling in, we wanted to make it grounded and make it conversational and real, because a lot of them we found, you know, just too conspiracy for us. Where we really like what we like about you and your podcast, Martin, is you have real conversations about finding the truth, and you know, it becomes like a really just honest, open dialogue about what's out there and what are the possibilities. So,
yeah, that's great.
And your live stuff too. I like the live show. I've seen it a couple times.
Oh. Yeah,
that's a live stream.
As far as I think it's great that you have the resident skeptic, you know, Curtis.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really funny. And so whose idea was it to have the gumball machine alien, you know, I mean, with all the eyeballs? It's kind of like a gumball machine, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Craig, you could take this one. I mean, it's always a collaboration, but I have to say, I think Greg.
It was mine. No, I'm kidding.
I think the eyeballs were your idea, because I can remember you saying maybe they go out like scouts. So, yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, we wanted to make it a little bit different than things that you've seen before and stuff that you would sort of predict in your mind. And we thought that, yeah, like an eyeball amongst eyeballs with, like, you know, hundreds of be sent out into the city to be looking for something in particular.
Yeah.
No, and we have some ideas about what that particular eyeball may or may not be attached to later in the series.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It sort of leaves off at the end like a cliffhanger a little bit. So you know for sure that, you know, the eyeballs well, I don't want to do any spoiler because I do want some people to watch this, of course. But at the end, it kind of leaves you hanging where, you know, there could be some left behind. Well, I'll say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
We also wanted with the creation of we collaborated with Todd Tucker and Greg. Forgive me. See, I always forget everything. What's the name of Todd's studio? Do you remember? Industrial Light
Studio?
Magic.
Yeah, really. I can find out.
Anyways, we collaborated with Todd Tucker, who's an amazing puppeteer, makes creatures. He did the Jim Caviezel full body for Passion of the Christ. And, you know, we really wanted this. We labored over this creature for a long time because we wanted it to, you know, look like something unique, that moved unique, that had a specific mission when it came here. Well, a lot of times when we watch sci-fi stuff and you see the creatures, we feel that, like, wow, people just get carried away and in all the things that all the possibilities that the creature can do and how big they are and all this stuff. We're like, we wanted to keep it really simple.
We wanted it to be scary, but not like I'm going to die any second scary.
Right.
You know, because of the age range, you know, we have to go from like 6 years old all the way to 60 years old. So it has to play for like a much, much bigger group. Illusion Industries. That's the name of it.
That's it. Illusion Industries.
Yeah.
Really great guy, and built us the creature. I mean, we came in with a bunch of sketches and ideas He drew it up, and our production designer, Richard Hoover, who is an amazing guy, he did the original Twin Peaks, Tony Award winner, just incredible guy. And he had input as well, and we honed it down to that. And then, you know, the eyeballs spinning around in the head, that was supposed to be like a beehive. So, yeah. He was a fun one to create, for sure.
Yeah, I bet. Now, it looks to me like it's a pretty hefty budget you're working with there. I mean, it's a very, very nice production, and, you know, great actors and all. I think that you're pretty serious, and I do want to tell the listener, check it out. And, oh, one of the things I thought that Curtis said was pretty funny that I wanted to repeat on this. He said, we've been doing this podcast for over a year and still have not found proof aliens exist. I love that. I've been doing it for 6 years, and I agree.
Well, to an 11-year-old, you know, a year is 6 years.
That's right.
Right? So.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Can you tell the listeners how they would actually catch this and also leave a review, right?
Yeah, it's called Skyward. If you go to Amazon.com/TV pilots, is that it, Greg? Do you notice I always ask Greg?
I think you can just type in Skyward into your Amazon, whether you have Prime or not. You can just type the word Skyward in and it will come up.
Right. Right.
And we ask that you watch it and give it a review, and there's 5 stars to choose from. We've found that picking the 5th star when giving a 5-star is the easiest because it's right at the end. So a 5-star review.
Yeah.
And then some nice comments, you know, little things like it's a show for the entire family. And then, you know, share it between you and 3,478 of your friends on social media.
There you
well,
go.
It's not that bad.
Yeah. Excellent. All right, guys. Well, thanks so much, and I wish you all the luck in the world. I really hope that it gets picked up, and I know how pilots can be, and I hope it gets picked up. You really put a lot of work into it. Take care, guys.
Well, listen.
Thanks so much. Martin, thank you, Martin. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
You bet. All right. We'll be right back with our guest. Richard.
Hey.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
Richard Thiem, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. We're on now?
Yes, we are.
Okay, then I'll watch what I say.
Not like earlier.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I heard you on Alejandro's show, and I thought it was fantastic. I love when people are really grounded, and that's what I think about you and your work. But you have quite a background. You've also been involved in the technology world. Do you want to talk about your background and how things morphed into your interest in UFOs, or had you always had that interest?
Well, I guess as a young person's kid, growing up as I did, born in 1944, there was a lot of exciting stuff in the media then. When you say the media, it's very different then. Mm-hmm. It was very limited. But I remember reading a book by Willie Ley on space stations, and it seemed very, very exotic and very futuristic, as well as getting satellites up and so on. So the world was expanding in terms of space, and UFO reports were around. And I think it's almost impossible, certainly it was for me, to just ignore them and not be interested in them. So I read a bunch of books, and that was about it. I read what I could. But in 1978, I was an Episcopal clergyman then, and I was in my first parish, a small parish on the edge of Hill Air Force Base in Clearfield, Utah. And a member of the parish was a fighter pilot, a guy with the real right stuff, heavily decorated pilot, and I was talking to him alone in the church basement one day, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind was in the movie theaters then. Hmm. That was, 40 years ago. And I mentioned to him that I had read people like Alan Hynek or Jacques Vallée, and I said, what I read is that you guys chase these things in your fastest fighters and you can't catch them. What's the story? And what I remember is that he looked perplexed. He looked serious. He was a pretty cocky guy. You know, he'd walk into a room with a Stetson and a cigar and a flak jacket, and people kind of gather around him. He had that kind of authority. Mm. But he didn't look that way then, and he said, well, that's right. He said, we chase them, and we can't catch them. Mm. So that was the moment I experienced what you'd call a contextual shift. And I think that's true for a lot of us, that somebody we knew and knew well, and whose credibility was unimpeachable, and whose authenticity and honesty was impeccable, told me that, yes, this is real. So it shifted from being fun and of general interest and isn't this cool to, wow, what's behind this? What is this? And how can I find out as much as possible about it? Now, I was a clergyman then. I was an Episcopal clergyman for 16 years. And I never failed to use the opportunity, and there were a number of them, during confidential conversations when people intimated something that made me think they might know something about it or had an experience, to ask about it. And so I did a lot of direct, I don't want to call it interrogation, but direct inquiry of what people's experience was over time. And as I did that, I what I call escalated my game. That is, I read the best people. I realized there was a lot of nonsense, misinformation, disinformation about this subject for a variety of reasons. I tried to escalate my game so that I was engaged with only the best people. And as I did that, you kind of leapfrog up the ladder. A lot of the people who were well-known and who were trying to make a living about this, writing books and so on, were not necessarily those people. Now, that trajectory, which included, as I left the ministry to speak and write full-time 24 years ago, and it was about, above all, the impact of technology on society, on people, on the human in the machine. What was this revolution we're going through going to do to identity? And so on. Well, that led me to doing a lot of speaking at security conferences and some engagement with people who are in the intelligence community. I'm not a, I don't belong to it. I just traded on the habits and character that developed during my ministry years to engage with people one-on-one in confidential conversations. And so in those contexts, more and more came to me. And I'm a pretty good synthetic thinker in terms of integrating disparate inputs, distinguishing what I know from what I know I don't know, and integrating it and articulating a synthesis. And then I was very fortunate around, 2007, to be invited by, I was talking to Jan Aldrich, and he mentioned this group that was going to get together in Texas to plan to write some serious white papers about the subject. For the reason, in part, to demonstrate to the world that it was a serious subject worthy of serious scholarly pursuit. Mm-hmm. And when we met, what we concluded was that nothing short of a book would work. Now, there had been a great deal of research done prior to them. We had a tremendous number of clippings and files. Mike Swords, the professor of natural science at Western Michigan University, and Robert Powell, who had headed up the chemistry department at AMD, the chip manufacturer, were the two leaders of the team. But there were people like Barry Greenwood, who wrote Clear Intent, and Jan Aldrich of Project 1947, who had been gathering documents and studying them with some real discretion and finesse and subtlety for decades, I would say literally half a century And we all contributed. My part, I'm always quick to say I had a small part, but a part that for me was instrumental in accessing and engaging with all of the material that over the 5 years it took to write that book came our way. And then there were other writers who did chapters on other countries, and a great guy named Steve Purcell, who did the thankless task of getting permissions and not including photographs for which we could not get permissions. And Mike has been my mentor, but I've engaged with these other people and paid close attention. I had a pretty good mind. I had taught English literature at the University of Illinois after getting a bachelor's at Northwestern and a master's at the University of Chicago. And then I had another 3-year master's when I prepared for the ministry. And I engaged with people also in a lot of interviews. I used the structure of MUFON in Wisconsin to interview people specifically and document what their experiences were. And some of those were astonishing, really. The end result of all that, now 1978, it's a lot of years, 40 years of engaging with this subject by engaging with the very best minds and students of the subject that I could find, and sitting at their feet and letting them teach me. I mentioned Mike. He is a terrific teacher. I mean, as a teacher, he was a terrific science teacher at Western Michigan University. And he was willing to give me very generously of his time. And once we met for a weekend, and he invited me to ask whatever questions I wanted to. This was the CUFOS headquarters in Chicago. And others joined that meeting, including Mark Rodiger popped in and out, and the Murphys from Michigan at that time, and a few others. And it was kind of a private seminar for 48 hours. Now, at that point, I had learned everything I could through the methodologies I described, but that was where I took all of the questions that it had raised, because I thought, what am I missing? And what turns out when you do it that way is, in terms of what's public, what's out here, in terms of the data, you're not missing that much. You may not be missing that much. We know a lot of the data, and that's what the book to which I referred is called UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry. It's published by Anomalous Books. It's a terrific book. It's 600 pages long. It's got about 1,000 footnotes, and every single footnote points to a government document or other primary source. And so when it came time to review the book for Choice is the name of the journal which reviews books for university libraries. They said, unlike the dreary material in ufology, this one stands out and belongs in every university library.
Unreal.
And
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's in at least 65, last time I looked, university libraries. And it said that because that data is bulletproof. It's all, as I say, government sources or primary sources, which over half a century, these tireless, obsessive researchers had managed to gather, and which we all parsed and pruned. But Mike had the synthesis based on the foundational work that had been done before. And now we're in the process of scoping out a second book on the phenomena itself and making all of these thousands, tens of thousands of files accessible to serious scholars, loading them into a website online. It's not available to the public. You can't just go there. But for serious scholars, we want the material to be available, and that's because we are getting along in age, all the people on this team, and we've seen what's happened. I mean, there have been some very sad stories of terrific people like Richard Hall, who sold his entire collection of material, the great author of UFO Evidence, to someone who now hides it away and won't let anyone have access to it.
Yeah.
So we want to do the very best we can to make sure that the data is available, because the reasons it's in all those academic libraries is because the data is bulletproof. And what we discuss in that book is the narrative about the government and how it responded in light of serious and genuine national security concerns to the phenomena roughly from the 40s to the 80s. And so we don't speculate. We don't say to people when they say, well, what do you think? People say to me, oh, you wrote a book about aliens. And I say, no. The word aliens, I think, does not occur in the book. UFOs occurs in the book a lot because we show how seriously the government took UFOs. The documentation in the 40s and 50s, as we trace it, shows they knew this was something really important. And there have been at least two major prongs, one of which is to, from the 50s on, damp down enthusiasm and excitement among the public by denying and by ridiculing and by debunking and by giving explanations.
Robertson
but on the other
panel.
Hand, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, we know that's where it was formulated at the Robinson panel. We know the Robinson panel didn't formulate policy for the whole government. But it looks as if the government did, in fact, follow the broad contours, which had those two prongs. Debunk it, calm people down, but at the same time, do research. Because they described the aerodynamic qualities of this technology. They knew it wasn't ours. And you're probably familiar with the estimate of the situation,
mm-hmm.
Which concluded that it was one of three things, right? Russian, American, or extraterrestrial. And they did their research and their homework and concluded that it wasn't, as the Air Force concluded, it wasn't Russian and it wasn't ours, it wasn't a secret project. So that left just one. Now what's happened since then, it's kind of interesting, is we only had that one category. Don't forget, we were just getting into space then. Mm-hmm. When was Sputnik, 56?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even know if satellites would work. And when we went to the moon the next decade, I remember very real fears that the rockets and astronauts would sink in moon dust and suffocate to death. We literally forget what we didn't know, which was almost everything. Now we're used to having Hubble images and X-ray telescope images and radio telescope images or renderings. We've gone all through the solar system, robotically, telerobotically, and explored our own solar system. The extraordinary scientific work, as well as the popular availability of the close-ups of our neighborhood. Well, that hadn't happened then. So part of the story is how we have expanded our own understanding, and physics has expanded or developed other theories as well. So today, people say, they don't just say extraterrestrial as one hypothesis. They say maybe this is time travel. Maybe we don't know where they come from. Maybe it's a question of when, because at the speeds that seem likely, relativity comes into play, and people are not going to come back at the same age at which they left. Maybe this is from the future, literally, by virtue of the speed of the technology which alters time in relationship to our time. Or maybe there is a multiverse. Maybe there are multiple dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Or baby universes that bud off. Those concepts weren't very thinkable then.
Right.
So that's why the only one people came up with was extraterrestrial.
Right.
But
yeah.
Now you know it's pretty common for people to say, I think it's common, maybe it's the people I hang around with, the universe is in all likelihood teeming with life, that where life can happen, it will happen. We have now managed to say there are billions of stars in this galaxy and billions of galaxies in the visible part of the universe that we can access. And it is impossible to stand before that network of galaxies without awe and without not just suspecting, but knowing that we're not so hot. You know, we're pretty recent
mm-hmm.
As a species, right? And I'm looking at electric lights here in my study, and those 150 years old electric lights. I mean, we're brand new on the technology plane, and anyone else who evolved sentient intelligence over thousands of years before or hundreds of years before would know things we don't know how to even imagine or guess or say. And my understanding is that whatever research has been done on these vehicles, we still can't make them do that. We don't know how to do what we've observed them doing, but we have come a long way in experiments toward doing those things. And you know, people say you can't get here from there, it's too far, but already we have exotic propulsion systems under consideration that would remarkably shorten the time it takes to get to the next star system.
I think that's very close-minded when I hear that statement, that you just can't get we don't have the energy, you know, because there's things in physics that we haven't discovered yet, or like you said, you know, we're working on. Now, you don't seem like the type of person that would guess on something, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If you had to guess if the government actually knew what the things were flying around in the sky, what would you guess?
You're asking if I thought the government knew what they were, or the identity of the animating intelligence?
If you had to lay a bet down, would you bet that the government knew what was going on, or would you think they're just as puzzled as everyone else?
I think they're just as puzzled as everyone else about some things, but I think they know a number of things. I mean, don't forget, the Air Force Academy in the 1970s had a textbook for the cadets at the relatively new Air Force Academy, and I believe it was the last chapter of that thick book was on anomalies, and that focused on UFO phenomena. And about half the chapter was devoted to some pretty good cases by someone who was familiar with them, and the other half was speculation. And in that speculative section, the statement was made, the uncorrelated data suggests that four different civilizations were visiting the Earth. Now that's a pretty big statement. That finally got out. It was publicized, and where, of course, was it publicized? In the National Enquirer, which meant that no one would ever take the story seriously. But the book was retracted, and that chapter was retracted and pulped, and a new chapter in the next edition said nothing like that and didn't have any case studies at all. So sometimes one of the ways you do research is to look at different branches of government and different documents to see what somebody said that they didn't know was not something they shouldn't say because they weren't read into a classified category, such that they would know that what they were saying was classified. So you might look at the State Department or Department of Justice or whatever, and that's what the researchers do. I mean, you just comb through everything to see what we can learn, and that's one of the things we learned, that in the 1970s the statement was made by the author of that chapter that the best guess was four different civilizations. Now, that does strongly imply, even though we don't understand the physics of it or the propulsion and so on, extraterrestrial. Because these are not Earth civilizations. They're not living under the poles. They're not living in the mountains. They're not a clandestine cadre of tall whites or small grays in cahoots with our government. Those are stories. And the question you always ask about any narrative is, where is the data? Where is the documentation? And especially in the Internet era, people seem to be prone to believe almost anything. When I give speeches, I have people sometimes ask me, do I believe we have rovers on Mars? Or do I think we really went to the moon? And I look at these intelligent people asking these questions, and it scares me and it boggles the mind to see that the consensus of understanding of what's real has so shredded that somebody could ask that question in seriousness, you know?
Yeah. Why do you suppose that is? Is just all the information and false information coming out, you know, I mean, with the Internet, just so much?
Well, I think in part we hoisted ourselves on our own petard, is the saying, when people don't know what a petard is or how to hoist yourself. But what it means is the responsibility for the conditions. They began after World War II, when the classification schemes and secrecy from World War II, which was appropriate, carried over into the Cold War, and they've never stopped. So we call it the national security state, and that's exactly what it is. And what it means is, I do a talk called Fiction is the Only Way to Tell the Truth. It's looking at what somebody did with it on YouTube. on a lot of my talks are on YouTube. You just plug my name in and up they come. And some of the things I show there were that the practice of disinformation rendered it almost impossible for the normal human being to know what was real. There's misinformation, there's disinformation, and now, what the Russian scandal has revealed is that you don't have to be Russian in order to have trolls. They have lots of trolls, and they comb the internet, and they create false stories, and they create false narratives after doing research on which kinds of people with what kinds of mentality are likely to believe the stories they create. And so I coined the phrase a long time ago of real birds in digital cages, that you create a digital structure in which people put themselves, and then you move the cage, and then you don't have to move the individual inside. They just come along with the narrative. And so it's resulted in a populace. First of all, critical thinking is kind of on the wane. A lot of people don't know how to do it, and education for it is not as strong as it used to be. And so a lot of people don't know how to know. I mean, it's questions of epistemology. How do you know what you know? And how do you document it? How do you verify it? A lot of people are just happy to repeat what's been repeated a million times, and often they don't know it's 1,000 websites directed and orchestrated by a single person or a single government entity. And we did plenty of that too. So in that environment, to get at the truth is very difficult, and it does mean people are going to be prone to believing almost anything, because some of the things we uncover are literally beyond belief. You can't believe people did that, but they did.
Wow. You know, someone asked right off the bat, of course, talk about a million times, the Roswell topic. There was never any type of government documents that ever mentioned Roswell except in the 1990s, right?
I'm not familiar with much on Roswell from the government, and what there isn't conclusive in terms of any narrative. When they did that silly story about crash test dummies, at a time when crash test dummies hadn't even been used,
right.
It's like they're saying, we're going to lie to you, and you know we're lying, but it's a way of telling you that whatever the truth is, we're not going to tell you, and you're not going to find it out. And that's the situation. We don't talk about Roswell in our book very much because there's no documentation for it. It's kind of an outlier. Most people are very familiar with the cottage industry called Roswell that's been built out of books and documentaries and movies. And you see enough of those. It's kind of like the gray on the cover of Communion. Once that's in the imagination, that's what grays look like. But we don't know. So the Roswell narrative has been fraught from the beginning with all sorts of assertions that over time have been revealed to be untrue. Witnesses who were not witnesses at all. People telling stories who were revealed to telling stories. And if there's some who seem credible in terms of the material, the remarkable material, and there's the fun story about Wright Pat and the Battelle Institute next door working on a new substance which had those properties of recoverability and so on. But that's correlation, not causation. We don't know. We've all heard lots of stories about recovery of bodies. But every time there's an image of a body, like the famous autopsy video, it's bogus. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take much to make a bogus story. It doesn't take much to insert a narrative into the mind and eager hands of what the intelligence community calls useful idiots. So we have a lot of documented instances, like the aviary once upon a time, and the alien who loves strawberry ice cream. It doesn't take that much, and if you want to do something seriously to throw the wagon off the tracks, the resources which military and intelligence and government people have are extraordinary. And these are, they make mistakes and sometimes bumble things, but these are professionals, and a lot of the time they know what they're doing. And when it's the more important it is, the more critical the knowledge is, the more ardor and money is going to be spent to make sure that nobody finds out. Because it is understood in terms of national security issues, and those go to the highest levels that they can. So, do I think there are people inside what we call government? It's probably not a government structure. It's off the books, mm-hmm. which is the way you handle anything if you don't want it on the books. And it would include corporate and military and perhaps government as well. But it wouldn't be a huge group, wouldn't be a huge cadre, and it would be a group of absolutely trusted individuals who trust one another and who now, several generations down the line, can recruit others from the next generation on the basis of knowing them. And it's the way the agencies now people are lined up trying to go to the agencies after 9/11. But once upon a time, a lot of the different agencies had kind of proprietary campuses which they oversaw as sources of recruitment. And in the senior year, a student might be called in to the office of a favored professor who suddenly says, I have some ideas for you about where you might want to go for work. And one of the signs that is happening campus-wide is when you have a lot of very bright people who you never hear from again. They graduate and they go on and you don't know. You can look at their finances, and very often they received an infusion of cash, say in the 70s, when they were kind of reeling, needed money, and the money came in. And there are other hallmarks you can use to kind of identify what those campuses were, where people could be observed in social, academic, and a variety of academic. It's not just a narrow academic training. And then they go on into dark work. So we're not going to get there. We're not going to get to them. And I've learned over time that when people approach me and suggest to me that they have some revelation they want to give me and they hope I'll share it from the platform, you know, the red flags just start flying at that point.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's a number of deathbed confessions that are on YouTube that you almost can kind of think along those lines, similar.
Yeah.
It's awful hard to know when you're trying to find out more about the subject to have the right type of filter. And
right.
And what would you suggest to, like, say, one of the listeners out there that's fascinated by the topic? How would you go about that? I mean, like you said, there's so much disinformation and misinformation, and now the British tabloids, you know, get involved with stories and with half truths, and so there's
right.
a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of jumble out there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the tabloids, I mean, let me just start with that, because the story of the National Enquirer is very interesting. It's not conclusive proof, but it's highly suggestive. The National Enquirer began in 1953, and Gene Pope, or Generoso, his Italian name, Pope, who began it, in 1952, what he was doing was psychological operations for the CIA.
Right, yeah.
and he left the agency to start the newspaper, which did not make money for a number of years. And a lot of hundreds of thousands of dollars came to him every year to keep it afloat, and a lot of it transited through Frank Costello, the head of the mafia in New York. And it's interesting because the Inquirer used to have a bulletin board up in the front hall, and they would monitor every week what the main front page stories were that you saw in the supermarket. You know, we're all familiar with that, and what the circulation was. And so they gathered the data over time of which stories sold the most papers. And it wasn't UFO stories. It was medical mysteries and celebrity scandals and some things like that. Yet the number one story in terms of quantity was UFO stories. Hmm. So why did they go with that? Well, you don't even have to believe that the Inquirer was started ad hoc by an agency to know that the agencies used all sorts of journalists and periodicals, good and bad, to promulgate strategies. When you say tabloids, that's what comes to mind. Now, given that, knowing how disinformation does work, this is going to sound disingenuous, but the best thing you can really do is learn how to think. Hmm. You have to learn how to think. And I once interviewed a profiler for the CIA, and she said what should be normal practice. She said, when you're about to come to a conclusion, when you're about to jump to a conclusion, stop. Stop yourself and ask, who am I to think that? Who am I to know that? What else don't I know? What is the data that supports what I think? And so before you leap into a conclusion, because it's a compelling narrative or someone said it, remain agnostic. Mm-hmm. Remain agnostic all the way. Back up and gather the data. And if you don't have the data and know you don't have it, then don't say anything, but don't believe anything. Wait, because you don't know. And a lot of people are unhappy not knowing, in the face of the unknown especially. And Nietzsche said very fondly that we call truth those explanations which have nothing to do with the truth, but they do have everything to do with comforting us and explaining away and assuaging the cognitive dissonance people feel in the face of the unknown. So the first explanation that makes us feel better is the one we say, that's probably right, that's probably true. Huh. And then people agree on it, and pretty soon you've got orthodoxy, and you've got a consensus, and everybody knows it. And so knowing that that's what human beings do, you have to take a very self-critical attitude toward your own knowledge and way of learning and understanding, and recognize that, I've been speaking professionally for 24 years, and I know that if I stay with what I know, I'm okay. But if I pretend I know something I don't know, I'm going to get in trouble. So if you know you don't know something, don't go there. And I mean that mentally as well as from the speaking platform. Don't believe it until you have some data that can help you understand what it is. Now, when you do look at the UFO data, let's get to the other side. I know it's impossible to talk to the people I've talked to over the years and look at the instances of encounters without knowing it's true. Now, the question is, what is true? Well, people have encounters with anomalous phenomena, which is intelligently operated and which seems to have at least a physical or scientific or technological component, but it also behaves in strange ways that baffles us, that seems to distort space-time. When we are in his presence, and we don't know what that's about.
All right, everyone, thanks so much for listening. And next week we have Chase Klitsky is going to be on, a repeat guest. She's always great to have on. And again, if you want to subscribe to the show for $2 or more a month, we could really use the help, and you'll get the full shows plus the Everything Else show, plus bonus shows like the Shag Harbor incident anniversary that we're going to be doing on location. So thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.